Well, good morning, everybody. Since we had a long weekend in between last class and this class, I want to go back and remind you that for factor analysis, the key underlying idea is that each observed x is the sum of these loadings times the values of the common factors. I wrote little l in the notes. So it's loading 1 times factor 1 plus loading 2 times factor 2 up to loading m times factor fm plus a specific term for x1. So if you think ahead to this Olympic decathlon example, we're going to say that someone's score on the event called the long jump, where you run and then you jump, probably has to do with a running factor and a jumping factor, but then there's something unique about that event. And the Fs are not directly observed. We are, in the end, going to estimate the Fs from the Xs. And so, as I said to some of the students in office hours, it really sounds like we're going around in circles. And in some sense, that's kind of right, but the perspective from some points on the circle might look better in terms of understanding things than from others. So this model makes a lot of assumptions, and I'm hoping that the examples, particularly this decathlon one we're going to do, will help pin this down. What happens in terms of sigma or r is the model about the common factor coefficients plus the unique one tells us that what we're going to do is think of R as created as a product of this matrix L, LL transpose, where L is going to have dimensions P by M. L transpose, when we switch the rows and the columns, will have dimension M by P. So its product is indeed going to be P by P, plus a diagonal matrix, which, although the notation is not completely standard, it's pretty common to call it a capital Psi. And this has the specific variances on the diagonal. And so what is going to happen, because of all the assumptions I laid out last time, essentially that everything is independent of everything with the Fs and the epsilons, the observed variance of x sub I, which we might denote by a sigma squared I, as I do on page 39, is equal to the sum of two things. There's this HI squared, which is usually called a communality. That's the part of the variability of the participants' long jump scores that's due to the running factor and the jumping factor. And then there's another piece here, this little psi I, that is the variance that is unique to that event. So it's a mathematical model that says what we are observing, usually we're going to do R, but what we're observing is a function of two things, and you need to have just this much of the matrix background to figure out how to interpret this stuff. How the heck are we going to estimate these L's in size? Well, that's been the subject of a large amount of theoretical statistical work. And basically, one method, the oldest method, was to start out with principal component analysis, look at the eigenvalues as we've been doing in our principal component examples, and ask yourself the question, how many are large? Which may be a relative concept. If you have a theory that says how many common factors M, you can build that into the solution. But often what we're doing is we're using PCA to determine this M, the number of factors. Or we're going to take it from theoretical considerations. But if you have a very exploratory analysis, this is usually how you start. So before we had computers, people essentially looked at the eigenvalues, decided how many are large, and they constructed L from the first M eigenvectors. And when you see people doing this, they're kind of doing what we've done in the lab, except then they're going to go back and estimate the size. So when we started to have more sophisticated methods, what we got from the L is we have an L P by M from essentially chopping up the matrix of eigenvectors, and then we're going to calculate L transpose, or we're going to have the computer do it. And then essentially we're going to take the difference, R minus L transpose, and take a look at its diagonal elements to tell us about psi. And iterated principal factors takes a look at your first L and the difference, and it looks around until it can get a convergence. So that was probably the second method that was invented, called iterated principal factors, and that's one we're going to do in a lot of our examples. And we're going to say, okay, step one, we're going to get the L from PCA. Then we're going to compute estimates of the HI squared by subtraction. And basically then what we'll do is we'll construct at step two, we'll look at R minus the matrix from these HI squareds and work with this matrix, and this will give us a new L, and we'll iterate until we hopefully converge. That takes a lot of computing. Then some very smart people said, well, what's our favorite distribution for continuous X's? Multivariate normal. And remember when we talked briefly about maximum likelihood, one of the requirements for maximum likelihood is you have to specify a probability distribution, which can be kind of tricky, but we're going to assume that our vector X is p-dimensional normal and attempt to use maximum likelihood to estimate the things in L and psi. There's a couple of things in the B space that talk about how to look at plots to check the assumption of multivariate normality. If you're going to do this, you're going to need to do that. If you want to pick those up for reference, I think that's a good idea. A big caution about maximum likelihood is if you look at this model, I have the P times M coefficients in L, and then I have P unique variance things. So I have an awful lot of parameters to try to estimate here. If I do this for the decathlon and I have 10 events, and I think there's four factors, I get 40 numbers in L and then 10 specific variances. And so we're going to be in a position of trying to estimate 50 parameters from a sample size that's about 150. Very risky business. The number of parameters in these models get very large. Even if you just think you have one or two factors, it's still a large number of variables to look at. So there's a couple of things, especially if you need this for reading papers or you need to do a for a project, that are in this outline, which I think will be quite helpful for future reference, if not for immediately in the next couple weeks. So we have two examples we're going to do of this, because interpreting these is tricky. And we'll weave back and forth with some of the theoretical comments as we do this. The first example we're going to look at is one I constructed, quite frankly, for teaching purposes, so you would see what it works out like in a very ideal situation. You're probably never going to get one this good. Okay, but it's called What Factor Analysis Looks Like When It Works. I made it an 8-variable model, and I built in 3 underlying factors, and basically what we're going to see is if these fancy estimation techniques can discover the structures I built in. So in some sense, the game is rigged, because if it didn't come out clear, I probably would have generated another one. Okay, but it's good to see a technique when it actually works before you start doing it on your own data, because you really aren't going to get any guarantees. Okay, so the first thing I did with my continuous variables, data created by simulation, is I took a look at the correlation matrix, and I bolded a number of the correlations that are quite large. And you can't always get a clear insight just from looking at the correlation matrix, but it often helps. So you can see from the correlation matrix that the way I built this example, X1, X2, and X3 are all fairly highly correlated with each other, and not so much with X4 to X8. X4, 5, and 6 have correlations with each other that start with 0.8 or 0.9, and so these three variables are fairly correlated with each other, and again, not so much with the others. And finally, X7 and X8 have a correlation of about 0.98. And if you look across the row, you can see that X8 has correlations with X1 to X6 that all have a zero in the first decimal place. So this is one where what we're going to see is that factor analysis is going to give us 3 common factors, and the variables are going to sort out just to be highly correlated with only one of the factors, which is what I said in the notes is kind of an ideal situation. So here's the principal components for you. A little bit familiar territory. I made this a moderate-sized data set of 150. People actually do try to do this with data sets of that size. And the first thing I did is a PCA on R. I got lambda 1 a little bigger than 3, about 3.06. I got lambda 2, 2.34. I got lambda 3, 1.94. And then if I had displayed these for your visual on the top of the next page as a scree plot, one of the things that we might determine from this scree plot, if we looked at it qualitatively, is we have 3 eigenvalues, very much bigger than 1. And then lambda 4 is about 0.298. So let's say it's about 0.30. So if you look at the scree plot for a visual, we have a big drop-off. It's all just the little talus rock at the bottom of the slope. Generally, you're not going to get one this clean, but the way I am looking at this, like any other principal components, is I'm deciding that I probably have three strong components, and then the rest is sort of random chatter. So that is going to be my choice for the factor analysis algorithms, that I'm going to take a look at three factors. And what I'm going to do with these iterative methods is I need some starting values for the commonalities. This is another trick for this algorithm. I need to get an estimate of the part of the variance of the standardized Xi's associated with the common factors in order to get the algorithm going. And the way most people estimate these things is they take a look at a regression of Xi on all the other X's and grab the R squared. Okay, so if I wanted to know what part of X1 might be due to my unseen common factors F1, F2, and F3, the way this works, if you think about the variance of the standardized Xi, it's going to be 1, right? Because I'm working with standardized variables. And so I'll take a look at this R squared, and then 1 minus R squared is going to be my estimate of this specific part. So Stata has some commands that can get these so-called squared multiple comparisons so that you can take a look at these. And in particular, if you take a look at what I have at the bottom of the page under the scree plot, you can see that the R squared, when I regressed X1 on all the other 7 X's just by using the regress command, is 0.7545. And Stata can do that for you for each variable in turn. Some of them are higher than others. X2, the R squared with the other 7 X's, is only 0.5959. But in order to get the algorithm started as to what's the common factor part and what's the specific factor part, this is one strategy people have used. So at the top of page 146, we have a factor command with our 8 X's. I told it to do this iterated principal factors to start with the eigenanalysis, to create the L chopped up, and then to iterate. You have to tell factor analysis how many factors to look for. It's one of the things people worry about in terms of the decisions you have to make. Most of you who've talked to me know that I don't so much like the word subjective, because usually these things are based on expert scientific opinion. But one of the weaknesses of this algorithm is if you tell it you want 2 factors, your 2-factor solution and your 3-factor solution will not be related. Factor 1 from a 2-factor solution just isn't going to look like factor 1 from a 3-factor solution. So you have to be really explicit about your choices. Here, in an exploratory sense, looking at the eigenvalues, I don't think anybody would disagree with my conclusion that I wanted to look for 3 factors because of the way the eigenvalues come out. So it's also very tricky when you get a factor output, there's eigenvalues. They're not the same as the original eigenvalues. Why? Because the eigenvalues from FA are for R minus the estimate of psi and not just for R. So to get the real familiar analysis, you really have to do a PCA command before you start this. So what I get out of this is, as is typical in one of these analyses, I get a matrix of coefficients, except unlike the ones we did with the PCA where we got 8 eigenvectors, this one gives 3 sets of coefficients. So if you take a look at the output, if you wanted to say to yourself, what's the relationship between x1 and my common factors, the answer is the standardized x1 is equal to minus 0.55 times the directly not observable f1 minus 0.40 times, sorry, it's the factor numbers, 7.0 or 7.1 times F2, go across the first row, plus 0.12 times F3. And again, these Fs aren't directly observable, but this is what the analysis is telling us. The part of the variance of the standardized X1 not associated with my F1, F2, and F3 is that last column, the uniqueness, which is about 0.18. So when you take a look at this, one of the things you want to look at is how big the uniquenesses are. Because if your common factors really exist, the part that's not due to them for each variable should be fairly small. If you take a look at X2, the X2 unique variance is about 0.36. That's not so good. I think one of the ways you can attempt to get a handle on what that means is when I took a look at the correlation multiply, the R-squareds. The R-squared for X2 on the other variables was the lowest one. And it turns out that we're going to say, essentially, in this kind of analysis, 64% of the variability in X2 is due to the F terms, and 36% isn't, because it's a standardized variable, the variance is 1. So in some sense, there's information in X2 that isn't getting picked up by the common factors. Okay, so Michael actually has to do some of this for his master's paper. Let's take a look at when I do the rotation to answer that question. One of the things I did in the really geeky matrix part is I talked about the fact that we have these so-called orthogonal matrices that have gamma-gamma transpose equal the identity. And what happens is that the L matrix is not unique. And again, this is one of the cautions people have had for a long time about this method. So we said in our introduction in the matrix algebra that what we were going to have is a decomposition of R that in compact matrix notation looked like L transpose, and again, this is P by M, so the transpose is M by P, plus this diagonal matrix with the specific vectors. This one is a P by P, but it's 0 except where we have the little size. So what happens in factor analysis is people come along and In this matrix product, LL transpose, we can stick in the middle of the sandwich an M by M identity matrix. And I did enough of the matrix multiplication with you to have you understand that that's just like in numbers putting a 1 in the middle of a product. So the identity won't change in the end what this product looks like. And then the people who really wanted to interpret their factors came along and said, you know what? Let's say, look for a gamma M by M that is one of these orthogonal guys, and we're going to stick in here, instead of I, we're going to stick in gamma transpose, and then we're going to group these things. Now, there's nothing mathematically strange about this. It's a fact that the L matrix isn't unique, that you can get different versions of it by looking for gammas. And what people said they wanted their gammas to do is to clean things up so that, as I said in the theory, an ideal set of coefficients would have each variable only related to one factor, and we would get all the variables covered. So there's a lot of automated computing here, but basically what happens is what I have in bold under the factor is we're going to rotate by finding a gamma to improve the interpretation. And physically in high-dimensional space, if you take this original L that we got and you multiply by an orthogonal matrix gamma, you're making a rotation. You can kind of think about this in two dimensions, where if you go back and look at the matrix notes, I actually gave you a 2x2 gamma that worked out that gamma-gamma transpose was the identity. If you're going to do this, don't do non-orthogonal factors. Go with the orthogonal rotation. And the one that we're actually going to interpret is not my original equation where the way it first came out, the standardized X1 used factor 1 and factor 2 pretty heavily with a -5.5 and a +7.1, not so much factor 3. What everybody does in factor analysis is they look at this rotated matrix, and when we go to interpret what is this telling us, what we're going to do is take a look at the rotated loadings. And the reason I constructed this for a teaching example is if you look at factor 1, it's only highly associated with X4, 5, and 6. If you look at factor 2, that one is highly associated only with X1, X2, and X3. Factor 3 is only associated with X7 and X8, which is basically for teaching what I build into this. The other piece of this is that with the rotated loadings, the standardized X1 is mostly just a function of factor 2. Okay, you don't get these things to come out perfectly, but I have a much bigger coefficient on factor 2 than I do on factor 1 or factor 3. The uniqueness piece didn't change. The 0.1787 part's the same. But these are what people actually interpret. So if we were going to look at something and we said, are there sort of subscales here? What we would say is it looks like there's three subscales, F1, F2, and F3, and then we would turn around and try to use the X's to take a look at the F's. Now, how well we judge the fit of this essentially is, can we look at the L in the psi and pretty much get back the R we started with, because we've done all this fancy mathematical iteration. So in order to do that, there's a couple of very technical things on page 47 that we have to take a look at so that we can understand how we're going to take a look at our common factors and our actual observed correlations. So I've just done a couple of illustrative calculations here to take a look at what these little L's actually do. So I took a look at our communalities just to take a look at what's going on with X1 and the uniquenesses. So basically, the communalities work out in the matrix algebra to be the L's squared added up. So if I do this in general, the communality for Xi, we're just going to go across and take the loadings on factors 1, 2, and 3 and square them. In general, we would have m of them. If we take a look at X1, the coefficients I wrote out there, I would need to look at 0.5539 squared plus 0.7064 squared, putting them in 4 digits, plus 0.1243 squared for X1. And if you take a look at computing that, this turns out to be about 0.82. And if you take a look at 1 minus the part that is specific variance for factor 1, comes out the same. Okay, so if you do the subtraction, I think I actually have a typo there. It should be 0.8213 and not 0.8223. They do come out within round-off error to pretty much agree. So what this is telling us is that we have a model that reproduces the standardized variance of X1 from these three coefficients in the matrix. And everything there is going to sum up. The second time I did it, I actually used 0.8213. So the other thing I wanted to do, because everybody gets really nervous if you're trying to follow this about these rotations, this minus 0.5939 squared plus 0.7064 squared plus 0.1243 squared, that's from my original solution. Then I took the new coefficients when we did the rotation, and I did the same calculation with the rotated loadings, and I now have 0.1368 squared plus 0.8947 squared minus 0.0453 squared, and that works out to be exactly the same number as I had with the original coefficients. And once I pointed out that the uniqueness part, original and rotated, didn't change, you should kind of expect this. But what really happens with this is people get nervous about searching for the rotation that makes things come out to give you these nice interpretations in terms of the subscale. I don't think that it's too controversial to do that, as long as you kind of explain that the math gives you the possibility of finding many L's and not one, and you want the one that's going to be most useful in the interpretation. I think the real challenge with this is figuring out that three factors is a good solution for this one. So another thing people do with this, after looking at how the specific and common variances come out, is we say, okay, We have an observed correlation with our original measures of X1 and X2 that's about 0.72. If you look at the correlation matrix, it's 0.7196. And the factor loadings for X1 and X2 are supposed to reproduce this. Okay, what we're saying in our factors is we've got this observed correlation matrix. We think there's three factors underneath it. How well do we do? And these are kind of complicated cross-product things. You take the coefficients, and it doesn't really matter if you do this with the rotated or not rotated. You take the product for the loading of X1 on F1 times the loading of X2 on F1. And you do this for each of the factors. So I did that at the top of page 48. And basically what happens is if you take those coefficients for X1 and X2 and put them all together in a linear combination, what you get from the three of them is about 0.7192, if I round it to four digits. So the actual correlation is 0.7196 from our observed X1 and X2. If we take the factor loadings, and this is in the little L's in the general outline, and we multiply them all together, the difference between the 0.7196 and the 0.7192, 0.0004, is one of the things we do to say, well, we said we were going to think of this as generated by three factors. The observed correlations aren't very far off. You can get all of these calculations done for you by Stata in one fell swoop. If you ask it to do the estimation statistics after factor analysis with the keyword residuals. So what Stata did, it says in the matrix, raw residuals of correlations observed minus fitted. It did this kind of calculation with the loadings for every pair of X's and gave us the differences. And if you take a look at this, most of these are very tiny. Okay, there's one that's 0.0238. for X4 and X3's correlation to get reproduced, and that's about the biggest. So if someone said, well, I'm getting very nervous about all of this algebra and finding gamma matrices to rotate, at the end of the day, partly because I constructed this for teaching purposes, my original X correlations are pretty closely reproduced by the extracted factor coefficients. Okay? So I would say that thinking about this model, the next thing we would do is if this were your application, is we probably would use the Stata techniques to get estimates of the F1, F2, and F3 values for each of my individuals. Because basically, if you're trying to do this to create scales, what you would want is the next step that I didn't really do here. I would use the X values to get estimates of F1, F2, and F3 for each individual. So if you're doing this for a project, that's probably the step that we haven't covered. Now, quite frankly, I would rather use PCA to construct my indices than factor analysis, because I think even understanding PCA is quite a stretch. And what we've just done with this example takes a lot of patience and a lot of trying to figure out what the numbers are telling you. People do use factor analysis. Taking a look at this one, I would expect that if I used all three factors, I would have a pretty good understanding of what was going on with my data. In terms of thinking of this as data reduction, I started out with eight-dimensional measurements. Now I've gotten it down to three underlying common factors so that it might tell us how to express things using a little less variables, even though these are variables that aren't directly observable. However, if I only took F1 here, I think I would be missing a lot of what the X's have to tell me, because I had really, in the principal components, three large eigenvalues. I think what everybody hopes when they do this, if they know that there's subscales, they hope to kind of reproduce them. So many indices are constructed, and we say, okay, there's one CESD score, but now there are people saying there's four subscales. I mean, you can take a whole course. I think they offer one occasionally in the Graduate School of Education on factor analysis, because many educational applications looked at how people were good in certain subjects that were correlated and said, well, is there a math kind of intelligence and is there a verbal kind of intelligence? Okay? That's a very complicated area, but what they really would hope is they would get a score for each person. They'd give them this whole battery of tests, and then the factor analysis would tell me, okay, what's the verbal score? What's the quantitative score? And you've all been subjected to that, right? So people at ETS, the Educational Testing Service, they do lots of factor analysis on the data that you kindly provide them. But this can be useful, but if I were looking for a wealth index, and this is actually what the demographic and health surveys do, I would just use a first principle component, and I'd really want to look at what percent that component accounted for. Now we're going to continue this cautionary tale here. I think that this one I constructed and iterated principal factors is a pretty good add for the technique. And I generated them using normal distributions, so I could talk about the maximum likelihood factor analysis. However, basically, maximum likelihood factor analysis on these data really does a crash and burn. And I'll show you why this happens. We did some things with you with the adjusted relative risks failing to converge in the iterates, and I want to show you how that can happen in factor analysis. So I started out on the next page with a factor command with my x1 to x8. I told it ML, it's not my initials, it's for maximum likelihood. I said I wanted three factors, because based on our study of the eigenvalues, that looked pretty good. And it goes through, and as with every one of these, normally you don't have to worry too much what's going on in the iterations as long as the thing converges. However, there's this little stata warning after it tells me everything that it's done. Beware. Now, I bolded it, but solution is a Haywood case, i.e., invalid or boundary values of uniqueness. What the heck is it talking about? Well, if you look through the output, what you have is that the last variable, x8, has uniqueness that prints is 0.0000. What's wrong with that? Factor analysis model says not everything you observe should be due to the common factors. If you look at the coefficients in the first solution, basically what it says here is that x8 is equal to 1 times factor 1. And it says that's not the way our model is supposed to work out. So once you get that, quite frankly, I don't think you should trust any of the output, because it's giving us a warning that the algorithm is not happy. Sometimes when people do one of these and they get in this difficulty, they say, well, maybe three factors was too many. A three-factor model would have 8 variables times 3 plus 8 parameters. I would be looking at a very large number of parameters if I did this, so maybe that was too much. I tried it just to show you what would happen and to give you a little more information. I tried a maximum likelihood with only 2 factors, which in some sense, looking at the eigenvalues, we know is wrong. But again, I got in this numerical difficulty with the beware invalid or boundary value of uniqueness. If they really crash and burn, you can get a uniqueness estimate that's negative, and that's not a good thing for a variance. Okay, this one is the so-called boundary value because it's 0. So the cautionary tale from me here, quite frankly, is be careful about the maximum likelihood factor analysis. Maybe it's because I only have 150 observations. I really don't know. And when I set out to make a teaching example, of course what I wanted was to give you a comparison of iterated principal factors and maximum likelihood, but I don't think we should do that because there's some numerical issues with the maximum likelihood. Something else I want to show you here, if you take a look at page 51, this is something that I have the details in the B space, but the p-dimensional version of the normal probability plot uses chi-square values. And we talked a little bit about this. It's in the notes on the multivariate normal. Here's what you get if you do a chi-square plot for Mihalanobis distances. You read this plot on page 51 just like you would a QNorm command normal quantile plot. How close are my observations? Each individual measurement is getting squished into one number. How close are those observations to the gold standard line from the chi-square? And basically in bold, because the data were simulated from a multivariate normal, these data are very close to the gold standard line. But in particular, if you're going to do maximum likelihood factor analysis, or if you're going to do the MANOVA that we're going to talk about in the lab, you really need to take a look at these plots, and there's directions on how to make them in the B space. Now, what's happening in lab this week is I've hijacked it for lecture. We're going to talk about an introduction to ANOVA for those of you who have never seen it. One way you could describe ANOVA is it's like the fruit flies, and you do regression on the indicators, but you don't have any continuous variable like the thorax. In some sense, you all know how to compare several groups. If you didn't have any continuous x's, you could use indicators. But 100 years ago, they didn't do that because multiple regression is hard. So we're going to talk a little bit about ANOVA. It's a good piece of background to have, but not crucial. The other thing we're going to do in the labs this week is we're going to talk about the multiple ANOVA, where we look at whole vectors of means. And many of the matrix ideas we've been using are going to show up again there. One of the reasons I want to give you just a taste of MANOVA is next week we're going to start looking at functions to try to classify individuals into groups. And if we can't tell that the means of the groups differ statistically as vectors, trying to classify people if there's that much overlap is going to be pretty hopeless. But if you're on a tight schedule and you don't make it to lab this week, the handouts are in the B space, and you can come, as usual, to any one of the four labs to get a look at this.